to Lou Krabs. And I know we've been sitting here for a long time, but this is an issue that I consider to be of monumental importance. There are a number of presentations that have been prepared for you today, including one from industry. So I hope we spend a little bit more time on this than the typical, are you willing to take this out to public hearing?
Mm-hmm.
These are some very important issues that are going to be controversial regardless of what side of the issue you're on. I'm sure we're going to get a lot of public comment once this hearing, if you go forward with a hearing. I'll ask your indulgence to listen to these fairly detailed presentations.
Commissioner, I would just like to let the commission know that there's going to be some information and the way it will be presented. This is not a public hearing. This is an informational hearing. But the information, the Blue Crab Advisory Panel, the industry panel, will start off with a presentation. In your materials, you'll find some documents behind the report of the panel, and those include, which were done in June of 2012, the commissioner's guiding principles for the panel, as well as terms of reference for issues that they should look at. The panel has been meeting for a little over a year, but I'll let the panel talk about that. Second item will be Dr. Lipschitz from VIMS and Danielle McCulloch will be here to talk about the recent study that was done of winter dredge discard mortality, and so they will have that presentation. And in addition, you'll have presentations from staff that include the request for a public hearing in October to establish a very limited controlled winter dredge fishery, and that'll be followed by Mr. Grist, who will make a presentation concerning conservation equivalency. So it'd be the panel first.
Mr. Smith. Is Ken here?
No,
I know I saw. Oh, Paula. Welcome.
Thank you for having us here. Ken had to leave earlier today for another appointment, so he apologized profusely for not being able to be here. Bill Mullis, our chair, also could not be here today because of a conflict. So I'm here as staff to the panel to represent and deliver the presentation. I also want to point out the fact that Jen Ayosa, also staff to the panel with Environmental Defense Fund, is here, and Joe Simoneau, as part of your staff, has been coming regularly to the meeting. So they can also provide comments as necessary on behalf of the panel. So thank you again for affording us this opportunity to deliver a report and an update. As Mr. O'Reilly commented, we've been meeting for a little over a year as sanctioned by the MRC. We were actually entering our third year sort of informally. And this idea came out of a CMAQ meeting a couple years ago where I believe there was some discussion about the difference between sort of the in-season regulatory decisions that are necessary and the longer-term visioning that's needed outside of that meeting. And BMRC at that point decided to convene this industry-led effort that had a wide range of input on that. And so this is how the Blue Crab Advisory Panel came about. We spent about a year just trying to form ourselves, identify representation, and come up with some of the issues. So you have the report in your folder or your files, I hope, that outlines some of the work that's been undertaken over the last year to 2 years. Part of that was coming up with our mission, which is to develop a long-term plan for both biologically and economically sustainable fishery. So they are considering both of those aspects. It's not just about an economic concern. The goals range from creating an industry that's both profitable year-round, looking at the economics of that, but also one that's able to attract new members, because I think most of you are aware that the average age of most watermen, not just crabbers, is increasing with every year, and it's a hard industry to attract and recruit new members into. So we're very much aware of that and trying to come up with new ideas that would create an opportunity for younger crabbers to enter that industry. Let's see. We do have a website that's available as an outreach tool, so if anybody is interested, please continue to visit vacrabbers.com, and it's got all the meeting information available, including minutes and any sort of reports and publications that we've been reviewing as well. In April of this year, we sent out a letter to all 1,516 eligible crabbers and invited them to outreach meetings. So even those that can't participate, we're able to provide input either through email, mail, phone, or attending one of the meetings. And our representation, we have 14 watermen, well, 14 industry representatives. It's a combination of dealers and watermen from around the state, and that includes part-time and full-time. It also includes many of our watermen are not just crabbers. They fish commercially for a wide variety of species. So the priorities to date that we've been looking at, and they are informed by the terms of reference that Commissioner Travelstead issued to us about a little over a year ago, I think. We've had external speakers come in and present to us from other regions as well. We've heard from watermen outside of the region as well as scientific and just topical experts and certainly industry concerns. One of the first priorities is the reestablishment of a year-round harvest, looking at the economics behind that and other decisions and some potential recommendations of how that would actually look. We had a subcommittee formed that met weekly for about 3 months to look at that issue really in depth and come up with a number of recommendations that we're happy to talk about in greater detail with VMRC and or CMAQ when that comes up. Lots of environmental assessment and trade-offs were available in that report. They're also interested in understanding and looking at incidental mortality across all gear types used in the blue crab industry. So I know Dr. Lipschitz is going to present on the winter dredge gear, but there are other gear types that have been brought up and discussed as well. Also, and lastly, the increased accountability, and that's been mentioned several times today about the need to report on a timely basis that's also accurate. To that end, we developed a proposal to the Virginia Sea Grant that was funded, and that's just beginning. That's conducting an electronic monitoring and harvest reporting pilot project where we're targeting anywhere from 50 to 100 crabbers to ensure that they report through VMRC's system online for the next year. So we're hosting three workshops at the end of September, early October. They're going to be, we think, in Glens, Melfa on the Eastern Shore, and on Tangier. And we're sending out letters to all of the watermen in those areas. It's not just open to the watermen. We're actually encouraging family participation because what we've heard is that sometimes it's the wife or someone else in the family that fills out these reports. So we really think it's necessary to involve them in those meetings as well. We've heard from Stephanie Iverson that we've seen about 3 times increase in online reporting since we started reaching out to watermen. It's not a huge number. I think it's only at 6 or 7% right now, but we started at about 1%. So we're hopeful to keep seeing that number go up. In terms of our next steps, we just wanted to let everybody know we're forming a larger report about our initial recommendations to deliver to VMRC and start that discussion with staff about how we would start to address those recommendations. And that would is coming out later this fall. I don't have an exact date, but I would assume by October we'll have that completed. We're also having the outreach and electronic reporting workshops going on throughout this fall and over the next calendar year. And this is an open invitation to everybody to come to any of our meetings. We meet once a month on Sundays. It's a tough time slot, but 1 to 5 Sundays. We've been meeting for at least 2 years on that schedule. It's typically down in Hampton at a hotel, but they are open to anybody that would like to attend. And with that, we're happy to answer any questions about our panel activities.
Any questions of Paula?
Would you say again your three primary objectives? It was new entrants into the industry.
Well, in the report that you should have in your package, there are 5 panel goals mm-hmm. that were outlined, and so they cover a lot of different things: co-management and leading towards an environment where industry has a say in the management, and they sort of had a seat at the table, creating a profitable industry that will attract new members, increasing accountability, really understanding the economics behind all these decisions that they're making and considering as well as the ones that are brought before you.
Okay.
Any other questions? Well done. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Glad you're here. Look forward to your future reports. You're all doing a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ron?
Yes, good afternoon. So we're going to have a two-part presentation.
That's right. Danielle's go up first.
She has coordinated...
A lot of tag team approaches today.
She's coordinated manage the project, so I'll follow with the...
Okay. Afternoon. While we're waiting for her to get set up, you'll recall, those of you who were here, back 6 years ago when we made the decision to close the winter crab dredge fishery, we took a lot of testimony about the impact that that gear has on the blue crab. We heard verbal reports that the incidental mortality was as much as 100%. Beyond what was actually harvested and kept. And some of that was hearsay, some of that was reports directly from fishermen, but we now have science to put some real numbers on the situation, and that's what this is about.
Thanks, Jack. I'm Danielle McCulloch from VIMS. Michael Sebo helped me conduct the field study, and Ron Lipschitz is the principal investigator for the study. I'm going to give a brief introduction, our study objectives, and then talk about our methodology and protocol for setting up sites, and then talk about standardized tows versus impact tows, and then Rom's going to get up here and summarize the final results. So to start off, the objective of this study was to mimic dredging practices and assess the effects of the dredge fishery on blue crabs, habitat, and bycatch. We also wanted to quantify what the blue crab discard mortality was, and pinpoint what factors might be influencing damaged crab rates. Specific factors we examined included sediment type, water temperature, and the presence or absence of divers on the dredges. In order to...
Real quick, describe what a diver is.
I'm sorry.
Other than a scuba diver.
Right. Divers were these square platforms that they would stick on top of the dredges to help them sink into the water and drag a little bit deeper. So we wanted to see if that would damage more crabs or was more efficient in fishing the crabs. So I'll get into our treatments in a second. So in order to develop a methodology that would both mimic the commercial dredging fishery and allow us to effectively assess an impact area, we developed a crab dredge subcommittee. And in our meetings, we applied typical dredging techniques to our scientific objectives and came up with a basic methodology that we later perfected in the field on the boat. The members of this committee included Joe and Rob and other VMRC staff members, myself, Mike Sebo, and Rom from VIMS, and then the four participating dredge captains. We chose the four participating captains based on experience, vessel condition and size, and safety preparedness. Each vessel was similar in size with a typical A-frame two-dredge rig. Each vessel was also equipped with a CB radio so we could communicate among vessels and also a chart plotter for monitoring our progress. Sampling began December 20th and ended March 15th of this past winter. We sampled with and without divers on both hard and soft bottoms, and each sampling day, VIM staff would board one of the four vessels. And from this vessel, we conducted most of the sampling. VMRC staff often boarded other vessels as observers, and most of them are sitting right here. So each day started with a scouting endeavor. The dredging team would tow in a designated area until a site was found. When picking a site, many factors were taken into consideration, but sediment type and crab density were the most important. Typically, we tried to only sample in areas that had a minimum of half a bushel per tow, so it was deemed dense enough by the fishery. Once a site was found, we would drop a large buoy, and then from that buoy, 200 meters perpendicular to tow direction, we dropped a second buoy. And then we instructed the dredgers to tow in between the buoys each and every time so that we created a concentration of tow paths. And this concentration of tow paths created an impact area from which we were able to go back and sample. Before we started any tows, though, we would drop a YSI, which would measure temperature, salinity, and dissolved oxygen in the water. And then we'd use a ponar grab, which is pictured here. And this ponar grab would be lowered over the side of the boat And once it made contact with the bottom, it would scoop up a sample of sediment, and from that we were able to determine whether the site was a hard or soft bottom site. And these samples were later taken into the lab and analyzed for sand content. And so we used that to verify the sites, which Ron will talk about. So after we set up the site and got the sediment samples and took the hydrographic measurements, we started our 6 pre-tows, and that was from the VIMS vessel. These standardized tows were exactly 1 minute long, beginning 50 meters from the buoys, and went through the buoys each time, 3 times in each direction. And dredge divers were kept on these standardized tows each time to keep them standard. Tow speed, direction, start and end coordinates were all recorded, and all the contents from these standardized tows were placed in bushel baskets for us later to process, you know, when we had enough time to do so. Once these 6 pre-tows were complete, we allowed the 4 vessels to impact the area. We would instruct the vessels to either add or remove their divers from the dredges according to what treatment we wanted to make that site. And then all 4 vessels began their impact tows. Impact tows were made to mimic the commercial fishery, so captains had free rein on speed, direction, distance. Their only stipulation was that they had to go through these buoys each and every time. And like I said, this created an impact area within the 2 buoys for us to go back and sample. Every captain had to do at least 5 tows through the area so that we had enough concentration within the buoys. And after those 5 tows, we left it up to the captains whether or not they decided the area had been fished efficiently. And once they decided that the area's catch had dropped off, we did our post-tows. And pre-tows were kind of our control. Our post-tows were actually how we sampled and assessed the impact area. And they were done the exact same way as the pre-tows. They were 1 minute long, went through the buoys, and we maintained the speed and direction and all that. So after we did all the post-tows, we would then process them like we did the pre-tows. And for processing samples, we would take a subsample of what we caught, and all the content such as algae, hydroids, clamshell, that sort of material was estimated for volume, and all bycatch was identified, counted, and assessed for damage. Crabs were measured from spine to spine using calipers, and we determined the gender, maturity, and condition of each crab. Crabs that had missing carapaces or really deep puncture wounds or were cut in half were considered unmarketable, and we categorized them as discard mortality. If a crab only had like a small nick or a few missing limbs, we considered it marketable and it wasn't considered waste. All crabs were kept until the end of the day to ensure that they weren't caught a second time, and that so we could keep track of all the damaged crab counts at the end of the day. This is a diagram of all of our sites, starting from the mouth of the bay going up towards the Maryland line. We had 41 total sites. The 2 sediment samples that we took at each site determined whether the site was hard or soft bottom. 22 sites were completed on sand, and 19 were completed on mud. And then we had 19 sites that had divers on the dredges, and then 22 without divers. The number of standardized tows that we did in sand was 114. We did 132 in mud, 132 with divers, and 114 without divers. Each day, VIMS kept a GPS track of where we sampled for the day. Just ignore what happened on land there. I think we left the GPS on when we were traveling in the truck. But this is looking at February 25th and all the area we covered that day. If we zoom in closer, you can see where we did our scouting tows, like these little concentrated areas, and then where we ended up setting a site. And then zooming in even closer, you can see this perpendicular line, and that's where we set the buoys and went back and forth getting the sediment samples. These closer tows, where you see these closer loops, are where we did our standardized tows about 50 meters from these buoys. And then these longer drags are the impact tows, where the captain had free rein to go any direction or distance he wanted through those buoys. zooming in even more, you can see how concentrated our toes were in this small area. So the captain of one vessel did the 12 standardized toes, and then he did about 8 to 10 impact toes. And that was about average for most site, but you can see just from one vessel how concentrated that area really was. So multiply that by 4, and you can see that the area was pretty well impacted. This is looking at 2013 winter water temperatures, averaged in Celsius degrees. And compared to the other 4 years, you can see that somewhat in the middle, it was a little bit warmer in the beginning, but kind of averaged out. I just wanted to compare it to the past 4 years to show that it was, you know, not an extreme year. For total bycatch, this is an order of most prevalent to least prevalent. We got a lot of hard clams, both the northern sites and southern sites. Channel whelks and knobby whelks were also prevalent. We got 22% horseshoe crabs, but most of those were caught near the bridge in the sandier areas south, and we got very few fish. Looking at total damage bycatch, even though we had more clams, they were only damaged by 12%. They were a lot more resilient to the dredge. The horseshoe crabs, however, did not survive as well. They made up 66% of the total damage bycatch. Again, this is just for standardized toes. Total number of horseshoe crabs we caught in those standard toes was less than 50. But for the southern sites, they were pretty prevalent, and it's something to consider. And now I'm going to let Rom talk about some more detailed results.
Thank you. Any questions at this point?
Yeah, go back to the chart about how many you caught on different ones.
This one?
Yes.
Okay.
So there's no majority, really.
I mean, it really varied. I just wanted to show what we were catching. I mean, we also caught things like starfish and other little things. But for fishery purposes, we put what we considered important species.
These are things that have commercial value.
Exactly.
That were caught in the effort to catch crabs were also caught, and some of which were damaged.
Right.
Significantly.
Correct.
Thank you.
Anything else?
What was the total number?
The total number for bycatch?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if horseshoe crabs were around 50, I guess you could estimate clams and whelks were around that as
that
well.
50, that's 50 horseshoe crabs per toe? Per
total for all the standardized toes. But you have to remember, these were only one-minute toes. They only covered about 100-meter area on average, so if we looked at the impact toes, it wouldn't have been fair. We wanted to keep it standardized, so that's why we're just looking at this.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Very good. Dr. Lipsius.
Let me just make a couple of, make sure that we're all on the same page. So for fisheries, bycatch mortality is sort of the catch-all term. Discard mortality is target species mortality, which then in our case was blue crab. Incidental mortality is non-target species, and that is what you just saw Danielle present. The other thing that we did not include in that particular report was the focus of this study was on discard mortality, blue crabs. So although we listed the incidental mortality, we didn't do a thorough analysis of that. We can do that. In looking at the data, what you see is that in a few, for instance, the horseshoe crab mortality is limited primarily to the lower bay sand sites, and when they're down there, you do get a fair number of crabs. We were getting a few crabs per toe, and most of those were damaged. So I think that's really an important issue. And again, we'd be happy to look at the data further and give staff or the commission a further report. Okay, so what we wanted to do was to make sure that we were covering most of our bases. So along with the standardized toes and the impact toes, then we also collected a lot of additional information for some of the physical variables. We thought there might be, and staff thought there might be, an effect of water temperature, that as temperatures either decrease, you might get an increase or decrease in discard mortality. So what you see here are three of the things that we measured: temperature, salinity, and dissolved oxygen. And they're a function on the x-axis of project day. So the project took about 84 days. Day zero, or day one, was December 20th, and day 84 was right around March 13th, 14th. Project ended March 15th. There was a definite decrease, if you look at the top one, for water temperature. First of all, what sticks out, there was no difference between our sand and mud sites. You can see they're sort of mixed. Sand is the darker color, the unfilled triangles of the mud sites. So there's no difference between those sites in the physical variables. That's important. The variables did change. So temperature, as you might expect, dropped through the season. Salinity sort of dropped and then maybe increased a little bit. And dissolved oxygen increased through the season. Now, the levels of dissolved oxygen,
the levels of dissolved oxygen are actually high. Low DO is not until you get below about 4 milligrams per liter, and that's way down here. We never even got close to that. The reason you see the slight increase is because oxygen saturation in water increases at lower temperatures. So temperature decline, we had an increase in DO. But as it turns out, none of these variables has significant effects on discard mortality. We were a little surprised. We had a slight effect of temperature, but there was nothing consistent. So this allowed us to basically, from the statistical analyses, to rule out these factors. And as you'll see, the overwhelming effect is bottom type. So here, what we also needed to do for the analyses is to look at the relationships between the different physical variables, and that's what you have here. And what this meant, all three of the variables were correlated, meaning temperature and salinity were positively associated, DO and temperature negatively, and DO and salinity negatively. What this meant is that we can only use statistically a single variable that could be viewed as sort of an independent variable. So we chose temperature. And again, there was no real relationship, not a strong relationship between temperature and discard. So again, we basically excluded it from the further analyses. One of the assumptions that we made was that when we went out, I say we collectively, it was primarily Danielle and Mike and VMRC staff and the dredgers, they would, in their initial tows, they would determine whether a site was sand or mud. So getting the grain size samples allowed us to validate that, and that's what this is. This is simply validation that when the site was determined to be a hard bottom or sand site, this shows that, in fact, what this is, these are all the sites that were called sand, and these were all the sites that were called mud, and this is the percent sand at those sites. And they're exclusive. Basically, what we found is that all of these mud sites were less than 40% sand, and all of the sand sites were greater than 60% sand. So there wasn't even any overlap. So that was good. I meant that the assumption about the bottom type was validated.
I do want to clarify one of the things I just remember. Danielle mentioned that the standardized tows were conducted with a VIMS vessel. It was actually VIMS staff on a crabber's vessel. So everything was done on the dredger's vessels other than some of the ROV work. So. Okay, so now let's get to the results. What I'm going to show you now, so the first set of graphs is the pre-trial. So these are all standardized tows. There's six tows per site. There's a diver on each of the dredges. And so this gave us a sense of the discard mortality that we saw on board the vessels. Later we would see, after the impact tows, we'd see what happens on discard on the vessels as well as what remains on the bottom. Okay, so this gives you an estimate of discard mortality on sand and mud vessels using divers. Okay, we didn't have the no diver treatment with this. And what you see is really a very dramatic difference between the sand and mud. I mean, it was We did analyze this data a couple different ways. Basically, the discard mortality one day on a vessel was about 10 to 14% of the catch in sand, and it was about a few percent, maybe a couple percent in mud. Very low in mud bottom. Okay.
Question.
How do you
determine what's your discard, meaning how about what you didn't catch, or is there loss around on each side of that driver, of that dredge?
You mean down on the bottom?
Yeah.
I'm going to show you that in a second.
Okay.
Okay, so what you just saw is the number of damaged crabs per toes. Here are the percentages that I was referring to. So, again, about on average 13, depending on each of the analyses, 11 to 13% of all the crabs that were captured on sand bottom were damaged. And those are damaged that are unmarketable, and also if they went down to bottom, which we'll see in a second, those would end up dying. So basically, it's a loss both to the fishery and to the population. And in mud, it was about 1.5 to 2%. And again, this is with dive. So now this is the damaged crabs per toe. So now these are our standardized toes after the crabbers have gone through and impacted the site. So now we go back in again with the vessel with divers, so everything's standardized so we can compare. And now this gives us an estimate of what is damaged on the boat as well as what was on the bottom that we caught. So let me take you through this. So that's why now we have the four different categories. So for this, let's just start with this one. For the divers, and remember that in the pretrial toes, it was about 12% or so. So that 12% is what ends up on the boat. This part is what remains on the bottom that we now capture. So what it's saying is that about the same percent of crabs, an additional same percent of crabs remains damaged and unmarketable or dead on the bottom. And you can see 22%, that is really high. We were getting numbers, obviously it rained a couple times, we got 0%, but sometimes we got as high as 70%. Really dependent. And remember that this is one day's worth of dredging the site. So about 10 to 12% ends up on the boat, and another 10 to 12% remains dead and unmarketable on the bottom. In sand, with divers. If you look at the no divers, then the percent that we get is much lower, actually, in sand. This is a damaged crabs per toe. That's why I was looking at it funny. Let me go straight to the percent. Here's where I was going. Sorry, I confused myself a little bit. I got ahead of myself. So again, the 12 to 13%, so now this is actually percent damage crabs. I apologize for that. Those 12 to 13% that was on the boat, and this is the additional amount that was on the bottom. For the hard bottom without divers, then, it's about 12 to 13% that was on the boat, and so there was an additional maybe 8 or 9% on the bottom. So the divers added quite a few percent additional damage on hard bottom in this case, probably about 4 or 5% additional damage. So basically what you see is the difference between these two is the effect of divers. So around 12 to 28, upwards of almost 8% more damage because of divers. Okay? So now this is the damage that remains on the bottom when in mud with divers. Okay? And so here you see that there is an effect. We've actually, when we run the analyses, it ranges from about 2 to 4%. And we're going to try to get a much better estimate since staff is considering looking at mud. Looking at dredging mud bottom with divers. Without
mud bottom, and again, remember, this is also where the horseshoe crabs are caught and killed. So mud bottom, very little bycatch mortality, or either discard or incidental mortality.
Mr. Plummer?
One question. You used the method of going back and looking at the content of the, I guess you're pulling up mud or you're pulling up sand and you're determining back in the lab, yes, this was sand, yes, this was mud. And you did it with a fairly high percentage of accuracy in predetermining the location of sand or mud. But there was some... There was some percentage of not picking sand or not picking mud. If we were to determine, one of the things we're going to be asked
actually,
to consider,
there wasn't.
There was no. There was no.
That's what I said, that all of the mud sites had less than 40% sand. All of the sand sites had greater than 60% sand. So there was a 20% zone where nothing. So there was absolutely no overlap. And it was a pretty clear distinction, and in fact,
the captains were able to determine they're in mud or they're in sand without really any.
In the initial toes where we were looking for sites, whether a site had crabs and what kind of bottom, because what we needed to do was to have about an equal representation of hard and mud sites, and also sites with and without divers. So we really need to be careful about what kind of bottom it is.
Where would you say that most of them fish? In the mud or fish in the sand or both? Or is there a preference?
I'd probably throw that out back to staff or the dredgers. I think it really depends. Some of the eastern shore, from what I've heard, some of the eastern shore crabbers like the sand.
Flounder, sorry.
Some are flounder, yeah. Oh, where are the... No, I think he was saying where do they fish. Not where you weren't saying where are the fish.
No.
Saying where do they
fish?
It really depends where the crabber comes from.
Prefer sand or mud?
I think they go where the crabs are. Yeah. And if they happen to be on the sand, that's where they'll stay.
the other question is there an what's the advantage to using the diver?
It makes it more.
That diver's a
makes
plant.
It more efficient. Actually, I go back here.
It's holding the dredge.
This is
I realize that. I wonder.
This is the number of damaged crabs per toe, and the number of undamaged crabs has about the same ratio, maybe a little less than that. So the diver makes the crabbing much more efficient, particularly in sand bottom, and a good bit more efficient in mud bottom. It's an issue of efficiency.
Brian, it sounded like you were going to ask a question about that, or make the point that at some point we're going to be asked to identify mud and
we're
sand.
We're asking the captain to identify mud and to keep his work on the mud or keep it on the sand or whatever we determine.
What you're going to hear from staff is they're setting up a meeting with industry to make these delineations on a map so that if we do decide to open, we will mark. You have to stay in these areas. You can't go in these areas.
We've already begun to look at that. My staff and I have already gathered all the available sediment data from the bay. That includes earlier studies from other scientists, as well as in our own dredge survey when we first did it over the first 7 years, first 9 years, I think it was, we collected about 7,000 sediment samples throughout the lower bay. And we've used those and the prior ones to create a sediment map that we'll then be discussing with staff. And I'll tell you, one of the initial things is that there's a very clear geographic delineation of hard sand and mud sites, fortunately. So I don't think it's not going to be a patchwork in most of the lower bay.
I think I read in your report that by far the majority of the dredge crabs are female.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes, it's at least about 95% mature females. Yeah.
Okay. Is that it for you? Any final questions?
I do have one follow-up question. Have there been studies? I know it wasn't part of this study, but has there been a study about the damage to the habitat in the mud?
That's a very good question. We actually have the potential for some future work, maybe funded under different sources that we're not sure yet, but to actually assess that question. What I will tell you is that there is absolutely no data that can tell us that exist in existence that can tell us whether what the damage to the benthic habitat has been by dredging. The reason is that the dredge fishery has been in effect for over a century, and there was no data collected prior to that. And so this actually, what's happened now, provides the opportunity to do that in the first time in over 100 years to actually try to get that sort of information. So what I can tell you now is my sense is that there has been that basically the bottom has shifted from more opportunistic species that can survive, very short-lived, small species that survive better under high disturbance, probably to more longer-lived species like clams, larger clams, big worms, and so on, that are the real food for fish and crabs in the bay. That's my prediction, but we would love to...
And that would be in the mud?
In both.
Okay.
Both.
One more last thought. There's got to be a real reason the female crabs are there.
Mm-hmm. The reason they're there is they're waiting to spawn. So these are all mature females that have already mated. Virtually 100% of them have been impregnated, and they migrate down there because when the females hatch out the larvae the following spring and summer, those larvae require high salinity. They have to be in salty water, so they will not survive if they're hatched out farther up the bay. So the females come down to hatch the larvae so the larvae can go offshore, remain in very high salty waters, and then come back in as what's called a megalopal stage or post-larval stage.
Therefore, that's a big supply of our crab industry.
That's the supply, yeah. Yeah, and that's why we have this variability from year to year, not just because of the spawning stock, but also environmental conditions that determine how many of those can recolonize the bay.
Okay. Joe, you're up.
Actually, it'll be Rob.
Okay.
We'll get loaded up here.
This is not straightforward. I'm glad some of these questions came up. And I think you'll find that staff is going to address some of the same questions. And I'm glad the commissioner indicated that this is going to be somewhat extensive, but I'll try to get you through it. But there's some pretty good information. My presentation centers on the stock, the fisheries, the management action, and the request for a limited controlled winter dredge fishery season. So if you look at the stock, what we've prepared here is the survey done by the Maryland Department of Natural Resources and VIM started in 1989-90. So each time you see a year here, it's the January to March part of the survey, where 1990 is really starting 1989, December through March of 1990. So this survey down here, 2013, was just completed recently through March, and you actually had some presentation of this information in April. So you look at the total number of crabs. This is abundance numbers, all ages, and you see several things. You see some trends in this ranking over here that 2013 was 19 out of 24, so certainly not terrific. When you look at the juvenile crabs, these are crabs that are less than 2.4 inches tip-to-tip carapace width. What you see is it was the next to lowest. You see that the lowest goes all the way back to 1992, but what you can also see if you want to peruse information is when that was low, it was followed by a very high amount of juvenile crabs. And in fact, if you go down to, say, 20, there was an increase there. So
there's inherent variability with the juveniles because what Dr. Lipschitz mentioned, the larvae being rubbed off, they are evicted out into the ocean, spend quite a bit of time out there, and they're entrained back into the bay. So there's a lot of variability. Anyone who tells you that the VMRC is the only manager of blue crabs is not quite telling you the whole picture, because first we have to start with what comes into the bay, the recruitment, and that's highly variable because of the situation with different variable measures. The CBSAC, Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee, found the juveniles of 2013 to be within the range of variability. That's what the committee came up with. This is scientists from NOAA. It also has scientists from Maryland, Virginia, that was the conclusion there. You move on to the spawning age crabs, which were just talked about, Mr. Beck, as far as, you know, what's going to spawn. This is in March in 2013 when this was finished. So either in late May or late July, August, those are the two spawning periods. So to go into spawning, you find that there was a fair amount of crabs over here in the females, 147 million. There were 180 males and females, but the females has what has been concentrated on for blue crab since 2011, and this actually was seventh out of 24. You may remember last year, although it said 97 at the time, 97 million, it's been refined to 95 million, that was worth some hand-wringing all around, and it was a low amount. And so this is the way the data are, and there's some other aspects besides abundance. There's something called a control rule, which I'm going to show you in a minute, which looks at removal rates and abundance and what are safe levels. I'll put it that simply. Well, here's a situation back when, before 2011, the unsafe level was 53% removal just by fisheries, commercial and recreational. You can see there were several times it was not safe. It went over the threshold. More crabs were removed than should have been. The control rule really popped up for the first time in 2001, but got refined by 2005 with another assessment and by 2011. It got refined to the point that it now concentrates just on the removal rate, the annual removal rate of female crabs. If it's above 34%, that's a big problem. That's unsafe. And you can see since 2008, that has not happened. 10% was the most recent removal rate. So it is possible to have low abundance, fairly low harvest, and a really low removal rate. You really don't want that. You'd rather have a 2010 situation where the baywide harvest was actually quite a bit higher. The baywide harvest in 2010 was about 90 million pounds compared to, say, 50-something recently. You want that high harvest, which is supported in 2010, got supported if we go back. I can show you in 2010 a lot of total crabs, 663 million, sixth out of 24 years. So there's nothing in stock assessment science. It all comes down to the catch is equal to how whatever the removal rate is times whatever the average abundance is out there. And so they work together. Here's a situation, male crabs, which need paying attention to. 62% removal rate was decided for males by Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Committee on empirical information. This hasn't been put through the same scientific scrutiny that the female crab removal rate has. And this female crab removal rate is for all sizes, what are called age zero up or age zero plus. It's all size of female crabs. You can see recently there have been some pretty high years with the male removal rate. So this just shows you, I'm going to do it two of these, but the first one just shows you the females and the males, the females in blue and the males in red. This is what you see in the winter dredge survey. If this went according to the way it should be roughly 50-50. The recent assessment done in 2011 says in juvenile crabs, and it should be in adults, there should be 52% females, 48% males. You have to go back to about 2003 until you find that condition of 50-50. And there's a reason it should be like that. Well, there's been a lot of management on female crabs since 2008, and what you're seeing in the blue is a lot of female crabs. You can look at this differently. You can trace it through the winter dredge survey from 1990 to the present, and you can see that it really spiked up here. It fell down a little bit in 2012 and back up in 2013. Here's the second part of it, and this is only part of the control rule, what's called the control rule. This shows overfishing level, or the overfishing definition, which is 34%. If you're above that, you're overfishing. And you can see there were years where the stock was considered as being as part of overfishing. The removal rate was higher than it should be. You can see that since 2008, not only has overfishing not occurred, the target, and this is for female crabs, and this is for age 1 plus female crabs, the zeros are excluded, that has been 10% is the recent one, but all below the target. The 29% is here because the Chesapeake Bay Stock Assessment Group and the jurisdiction said, what happens if we keep the same harvest in 2013 that we did in 2012? And the answer was there'd be a 29% removal rate, which is getting fairly close to the threshold. The response by the jurisdictions was to reduce the harvest by 10%. The bushel limits this commission passed in November was our 10% portion. Maryland is actually reducing their bushel limits, and the Potomac River Fisheries Commission is changing the days that they're allowed to fish in their two areas. And I did hear myself, but this is really not just age 1 plus. This is 0 plus. So this is all age crabs in the exploitation rate or the removal rate. This is the control rule, both parts together. So here you have running vertically, you have where something is overfished. So if you're to the left of this line in terms of the abundance, here's the abundance on the x-axis. If you're here, there's some real problems because you overfished the stock. That means you have to do everything you can to come out of this overfished condition. On the other hand, if you go horizontally, this is the overfishing line, the threshold. You can see there are quite a few years above here. You don't want to be there, but it's certainly a lot easier to come back from overfishing than it is from overfished. And you can see the 2012 data point fairly low on the abundance, and these are the age 1 plus. So these are female crabs 2.4 inches and larger. You can see that fairly low, but still in a position that if there's not an overfished condition. And you can also see, on the other hand, the exploitation rate was very low, well under this target. The target is set by managers generally. The threshold is set by science, by a model. The target is set by managers to give them a buffer from that overfishing area. So this is 25.5%. This is 34%. I'm going to move a little bit to the fisheries. This shows you the long-term 50 years of landings, which lasted from 1964 up until about 1972, and then the rest of this is harvest. The difference is back here with just landings, and you heard this earlier today a little bit at lunch, there could be a little bit of North Carolina, Maryland crabs landed here. Here it's all strictly from Virginia waters from 1973 on. What you see is what someone might be tempted to call a regime shift. You have very high total harvest here. It drops off. I mean, above 60 million pounds back when reporting was voluntary. So you can imagine it was an underestimate, how much, hard to say. Then you drop off, and maybe here's a third regime down here in these years. Of course, a few of these years were enough to successfully petition National Marine Fisheries Service for disaster relief based on 2004 to 2007. One other thing, which is just a little piece of information, we often hear about the ecosystem and what the ecosystem can hold and competition. It's interesting that the highest point of striped bass lasted from about 1960 to 72, prior to 1995 when it was restored accordingly to the ASMFC. Blue crabs were abundant in that time period, as were striped bass. What about puppy drum that we've had here? You heard a lot about that last year. How much does that add to it? What about other species? Blue catfish have extended their salinity tolerance. I mean, so maybe we have a more complicated ecosystem than we did in the 60s. You could say perhaps there's some effort changes. That's going to be tough to trace because we really don't have good effort data. We just have nominal license data. This is very busy as a slide, but it's an important one because it tells you about the crab pot and the peeler pot fisheries by month. And you can see also the annual totals. You can see the 2013 is very preliminary, but you can see generally that the low point of 2008 at 18 million pounds of hard crabs in this upper graph did see a resurgence for a few years. There was a nice upturn following the initial situation, and the commission worked hard to reduce the female harvest by 34%. The peeler fishery, the one thing I want to point out now, and I do promise these will be back later on for you to look at, but the peeler fishery has been very flat and declining a little bit, but it's been flat pretty much since 2006. And this is a fishery that at one point got up to 2.5 million pounds by 2004. I mean, it got up there very quickly, and then it started to decline. We are looking at the effort. We do have effort slides. I won't show a lot of those. This is shown because the crab pot fisheries, which includes both peeler pot and hard crab pot, and the dredge fishery, where the season was stopped in April 2008, were the two biggest fisheries. You can see here at one time, if you look at the harvest, it just shows about 7 million pounds. The dredge fishery before this time in the late 80s was as high as 10 and above, a little above 10 million pounds. The value for the dredge fishery, you can see tails off with the harvest, but you can also see at one point it was several million dollars. You can do the same thing over here. The one notable situation you might look at is that when the dredge fishery season was closed, there was an immediate response by the pot fisheries. You know, they took up that situation, which makes you think, what's there? It's patchy, it's clump distributions, but it will be removed by something. And this shows it again. You can see the rise in the crab pot pretty significantly. It started to tail off last year, 2012. This just shows you a little bit of effort to show you 2008, which is this light blue, or darker blue, 2008 runs this way, was really a low point as the commission took some action. It really was a low point. 2010, which I mentioned earlier, which had high abundance of crabs, you can see with the green line that really did turn out to be a pretty good year considering this mix of years. The other thing to look at with these dark squares is 2012, and March of 2012 was just extraordinary, and I'm not sure that's in a good sense. In March, all of a sudden, it went from the highest we had was just about 1.1 million pounds, typically several hundred thousand pounds in March. In 2012, 2.4, 2.5 million pounds just in March. The significance of that, March in the pot fishery fishes on the same crabs that the winter dredge fishery fishes on when it was in operation. These are the same crabs that have to make it to late May or July, August to spawn. And they're sort of the real challenge. You do have a couple of months, March and April and part of May, where the harvest can really take quite a few of the spawning potential out. So that does happen, and it has happened here. It did not happen in 2013 because of the weather conditions. Matter of fact, 2013 was probably, I'm going to say a couple hundred thousand pounds. Staff can correct me. Maybe 300,000 pounds, just a fraction of what it was in 2012. This is just to show you very quickly something about the number of harvesters in the fishery. They peak in the summer months. They fall in autumn. The numbers fall down in autumn, and they start out a lot lower too. But you're looking here, 750 harvesters. All that's down here, and I won't spend a lot of time in it, you have to go vertically through the months to see which is the highest month in poundage for harvest versus the lowest month. And what you see pretty consistently was 2009 tended to be pretty high harvest.
Harvesters,
pardon me. Thank you, Joe. Pretty high number of harvesters, even though 2010 ended up the highest harvest. So this is harvesters. This is the average blue crab pounds per harvester just for the most prolific pot category, which used to be the 300 pot category, and in 2008 it became the 255 pot license, another action by the commission. And the reason it's prolific is you've got a lot of harvesters with that pot category. You only have about 32 harvesters who have the highest category, 425. There are several hundreds in this category. And what you see with 2008, you see in the red line here that it really falls down by November. Well, that's because action was taken. October 26th is when the commission closed the season in 2008. You have to go back to 2010 as the time you had that abundance that I showed to you, the 656 million total crabs, and you see that 2010 is really where everyone would like this fishery to perform in terms of catch per unit effort or catch per harvester in this case. And I didn't point it out earlier, but there's a target where the preference is to have 215 million crabs. That did happen in 2010, almost happened in 2011. It's not an impossible situation at all. So this is peeler pot harvest. An anomaly here is the 2012. March does not belong there too much, but April is where there was more harvest than any other April within this five-year period. It got offset. May is typically 50 to 55% of the peeler harvest, but not in 2012. The significance of that, that needs to be explored by someone as to what that means, especially if it shows up again. Same idea. These are harvesters, and you can see right away that 2009 had a lot of harvesters. So the take on that is that 2008 was when the actions to have a 34% reduction in female harvest occurred. In 2009, it appears the harvesters were ready. I mean, they were out to try and see what they could do because the harvest didn't turn out to be as good as 2010 or 2011. So there is a management plan, and in your document, in your evaluation, you have quite a few documents that were provided to you because they are good reference documents. They really provide the history of management by the commission since 1994. One of them is a 22-point crab management plan, which goes through 2007. One is the deliberations of the Regulatory Review Committee, the Blue Crab Regulatory Review Committee, which met in 2007 and had scientists and ecologists from South Carolina to Maryland that met here on three different occasions, and a report was prepared. Another document provided to you is the annual report to the governor and the General Assembly. Those three documents have anything you might want to know about what has occurred with the resource and its fisheries over the last 20 years. So that's the importance there. In terms of the commission's management plan, you can see in the 22-point management plan that the spawning sanctuary, which used to be just a lower bay, relatively small, 146 square miles, was increased substantially. Today, in the bay alone, it's 865 square miles. So that's a pretty tremendous increase of the spawning sanctuary. It's not that there aren't debates about the spawning sanctuary, especially only in the northern end. I don't think anyone would debate the wisdom of those associated with establishing the 1942 sanctuary with its location and the fact that it is a definite location of spawning crabs. Coal rings were established, and there was a measure to prohibit the possession of dark-colored sponge crabs, which continues to be a thorn in the side of CMAQ, but so far, I mean, it does have merits. And then, importantly, there was a moratorium on additional commercial licenses, which was established in May of 1999 and still exists. And there's still excess effort, but there is a moratorium and has been. The Blue Crab Regulatory Committee met, and it came down to effort control. The most important thing that committee talked about was there need to be effort control systems in the fisheries, and they only looked at one other real idea. I mean, they looked at several ideas, but the other recommendation was on a cull ring, which has been done. We have two and three-eighths, so a slightly larger cull ring than was recommended in pots. They also did quite a bit to look at our regulations, and at the time, what they decided was the regulations did prevent a further slide in the resource, and that was the benefit overall, that it was very difficult to pinpoint any one regulation as to its effect. The governor's report, which I mentioned, these are the elements that are provided each year by December 1. I want to talk just briefly, because it's something we're asking about for an advertisement. It's about agents. Agents have brought out a lot of conversations with the Crab Management Advisory Committee. And in 2012, the recent agent situation was to allow those who had a license in 2012 or who had transferred that license to someone and also had an agent attached to that license or had an agent themselves in 2012, they should be allowed a 2013 agent license. That's the commission passed, as well as having, and that brought it up to 153, as well as having 10% allowance for new agents, and that brought it up to 168. And on top of that, the commissioner was enabled to provide for hardship exceptions. I think there were only four of those in 2013. So that was the system. CMAQ, really, we're not sure what they want to end up with on agents. It was a labored discussion the other night, as Ms. Haney can tell you. And it just wasn't clear to us that there's a direction that we know what we should tell the commission. So instead, what we'd like to tell the commission is that we should continue what we're doing. And in addition, we should develop something that really was not to our advantage this year. We should develop a notification system where we can have notification by February 28th saying that someone will have an agent. What happened this year is we sent letters to everyone, but only some replied, so we didn't know whether they were going to have an agent or not. So it was not a good system. We have this system for the American shad bycatch fishery, a declaration time, and if we have that, then we can know, all right, we can add some agents up to the cap of 153 plus 10%. So this will continue. I think there is a situation with the agents that will also be looked at by the committee, and we'll see how that goes. So here's the proposal. So two previous calendar years would be currently in 2012. But if you had one in 2012, chances are most of you who have agents will still have an agent.
Is this something that you want to have advertised?
Yes.
Okay. So this is for specifically for 228. Okay.
Yeah, that's why this is here now. A little bit about CMAC, and they did have an allowance of agents working alone. What this really boils down to is it was CMAC that proposed the vessel limit. If you recall last year, things started out with different bushel limits for different pot categories, but it was unclear whether that would serve conservation if folks doubled up or whatever they did, and CMAC came up with the idea that the vessel limit should be tied to the person on the vessel with the highest allowed pot category bushel limit. So if you had two on a vessel, one had a 255 pot, one had a 425 pot, that vessel is held to the 425 pot, which is 55 bushels right now. So that's what CMAC did, and it was a great discussion, by the way, that they had. So they have that motion. Here's something from recently, August 19th. CMAC voted 6-3-1 to allow 1.5 million pounds of quota allocation for the upcoming winter dredge season. That's a little misleading in that that is not a vote for whether or not to have a season. That was a vote on 1.5 million pounds. And as one committee member explained to me, the idea of that no vote was because there has to be paybacks first announced. There has to be conservation equivalency before that committee member would have said, okay, I understand 1.5 million pounds. This is what else happened. April 1 was not looked upon favorably as a way to have conservation equivalency, as you'll hear Joe Griss talk about. However, you also saw several slides ago that if conditions are right, the weather's right, temperatures are right, that March can be a very big take of spawning potential. And what I want to mention is anything you see on conservation equivalency includes two things. It includes the pot fishery, and it includes the proposal for a limited winter dredge fishery. So the rest of this is going to be about the winter dredge fishery season. This is the law that the commission has in terms of what it can do for a dredge season. And, of course, it can close the entire season right here, as well as delay. That has to be done on an annual basis. There was a ruling on that, and that has been done on an annual basis. So there have been two reports, and you have them. One is that in 2000, there was a special Senate Joint Resolution number 397. Your report is included, and it specifically charged the commission with looking at the winter dredge fishery and its impacts. And it was really Old Dominion University scientists and BIM scientists who met to deliberate, discuss, look at information, look at data. And the kind of conclusions they came up with are here. That task force in 2000 did not recommend it be singled out, the winter dredge fishery, for additional restrictions. However, there could be restrictions if other fisheries were restricted, the crab pot, the peeler pot, scrapes, pounds, whatever. And that's exactly what happened in 2008. All the fisheries pretty much got some treatment of helping on the 34% reduction. Also, the task force said there's the potential to impact the number of overwintering crabs, so it doesn't recommend an expansion of the fishery. Well, as you know, overwintering crabs can be impacted by the dredge fishery, but come early spring, they can also be impacted, the spawning crabs, by the pot fishery. The task force recommended that other blue crab fisheries be assessed for their impact on blue crab stocks. And the task force recommends increased funding. I don't think that happened, but that was a recommendation. One thing to consider, which I don't want to neglect to tell you, impact on blue crab stocks. Earlier, I presented information about how simple it was that the catch and the exploitation rate and the average abundance tells you the status of the resource. It is the catch, but we only use the harvest. The exploitation rate is not based on catch. It's based on harvest because no one has provided any estimates up until we have some estimates from VIMS on the dredge fishery on the other fisheries. And some of those discard mortality estimates, like in the crab pot fishery or in springtime with the peeler pot fishery, are probably fairly substantial. But they're not included because the science hasn't been done to come up with those estimates. Most fin fish stock assessments include catch. They include the discard mortality and the harvest. So I did not want to neglect to tell you that. The other interesting thing about this report, VIMS and ODU came up with a pipe. You'll see it in your document. And the pipe has different spigots, if you will, of the take or the removal of female crabs and a spawning potential. And wherever you look along that pipe, whether it's the crab pot fishery, the winter dredge pot fishery, the peeler fishery, whatever you want to name, that is one of the spigots that's removing female potential. The second report we talked about was the Regulatory Review Committee, and the findings were that this was an early attempt to limit entry back in 1993. Industry initiated limited entry for this fishery and said, let's get these 300, there were over 350, 360 licenses, let's get them down to 225, and if it falls to 220, we'll bring it back to 225. Of course, the participation started to slide off at that point anyway. And you see some of that here, 67 participants in 2006-2007 who did some harvesting. And the Regulatory Review Committee was very similar in that they said do not expand fishing mortality in the winter dredge fishery relative to other blue crab fisheries and address the risks posed by latent effort. So at that time, and you're going to see a graph of this, there were quite a few licenses, but a lot of them were not participating. That was latent effort. This is harvest by dredge season and month, and I'm going to start flying a little bit, but this is the total of everything, and this is the month. And as you would expect, December has been the big month. December is also usually lately a warm month, and if crabs are crawling, you really don't want to be dredging. And that comes not from me, that comes from industry. So you can see that December and January typically are the months. It's always tailed off after that. by the time you get into March. There might be some occasional good days. That's about it. These are the trips. They mimic the harvest, December and January. And you can see it tail off by 2007, 2008, as does the total. These are the number of harvesters, and here's where we start. Just in 1993, there were far more going back in time because 1900 was the first time this gear was put in Virginia waters. And down to 69 here, you can see the progression, same progression, December through March. This little S is season. So here's 1993, 1994. Not the high point, but close to 8 million pounds. And 2007, 2008 was about 1.4 million pounds with a reduced, very reduced participation. And some fluctuations in between. You could go back further, but you know, I think everything is right here to give you the picture. Here's the participants that I mentioned, 343 back in 1993-94 in terms of really the latent effort is from there to here. So 244 licensed, 159 here. By 2004, there were recommendations, and the commission adopted them, that the winter dredge fishery participants did not need to buy a license. They could just stay eligible and not fish, which is similar to what we have for other fisheries now, our crab pot fishery and our peeler pot fishery. Value. Usually, everything I have heard for quite a long time is that the dredge crab is a poor quality crab. And I think most of that relates to, are you getting dredge crabs out of the sand compared to mud? And I spoke to a buyer the other night after the CMAC meeting, and he told me, he said that when he buys crabs, and now, because he bought some of the study crabs that UMRC participate in, but also in the past, he would just lower his price as soon as he saw the crabs were coming from sandy area. And he would force the dredgers into areas such as mud, where they could have a better quality crab because there's a better shelf life with a mud crab that's burrowed compared to a sand crab. But if you look back, there were some high prices here. You know, a dollar a pound is a pretty good price, especially when you look at all gears without dredge, you know, which is mainly crab pot. You know, crab pot is and peeler pot together are 97% of the fishery right now. And then you can see the study. This is the study, in case you were wondering. A very good price there. Price fell here. Our understanding is there was competition at that time. And, in fact, right now, Delaware still has a crab dredge fishery. But other places are producing imports for us. And maybe that tells some of these prices here. So, limited entry is something the commission is very familiar with. It started in 1992 with the striped bass fishery, and there have been quite a few fisheries since then for limited entry. This is one of the cleanest limited entry situations, regardless of how things end up, that I've looked at, because you have 171 unique harvesters. And this is what happened. In the last five winter dredge seasons, which started in 03-04 and ended with 2007-08, 37 of the 171 participated in all five. 21 participated in four of the five, and 71 only participated in one of the five. So participation is always a key element, starting point for limited entry. If you move this to a 10-season period, the last 10 seasons, what you see is of the 37, 33 participated in the past 10. And of the 21, 15 individuals participated in nine, five here and four here. So there's plenty of information on participation. If you go the next step, you would look at either harvest or effort, days fish, something like that. So up here, this is all about the 37 individuals that you saw on the first chart in the blue bar who participated all five seasons. And this tells you what their harvest was, the magnitude of it. And if you come over to the right, you can see that 10 harvesters really were in a low range. So the pie could be divided even more based on harvest. Four individuals are in the very large production. 3,250 is the bushels times 40 pounds. That's a lot of production. And some in the middle. Same thing with trips. A little different. Very few trips here. Two individuals were somewhere 1 to 10. The same four were in the 51 to 70 days of fishing. The two is mentioned because earlier I indicated in 2004 the commission allowed crab dredge fishermen not to buy a license, but they had to report some measure of having reported or worked. And there was always information that some dredgers were reporting even though they didn't work just to get on the books. So that might be something telling. So this is another avenue, harvests and trips on the 37 or on the 37 plus 21. Staff has already contacted 33 of the 37 individuals. Four, and it was a very carefully worded telegram for the phone calls to where they were asked, would you participate, but there is no guarantee that there's going to be a fishery season, but if there were, you know, along those lines. And four said no out of 37. Four were trying to still determine out of 37. Three have no usable phone number. One just can't get in touch. So we don't know about those four, but that definitely tells you there are 29 who say they would. And that's what we know to date, and the commissioner thought it was important to give you that information, to give you some idea of what is the interest out there, because we've heard there would only be 22 boats. If a fishery season opened, there would only be 35 boats. We've heard everything. This does the same thing, but it's on the ones who had really 9 years, the four or five the first year and then the five. And it shows a much different situation. It shows that there were some pretty significant harvests, but six of those 21 really didn't harvest very much at all. And down here, the same idea. No large trip amounts, days worked, somewhere low here. So if you compare that to 37, it's quite a big difference. And the data are formatted this way because there's confidential data. So we have to lump information when it involves less than three individuals. That's why you have these categories. We can provide the commission, of course, with individual records that can be collected after the commission meeting, if that's what your wish is for October. So there's a public hearing request for the October public hearing to determine the season length, what areas should be dredged. You have Dr. Lipschitz's report that there's a large difference in terms of sand, hard bottom versus mud bottom. It would have reporting requirements, observer requirements from staff, the ability to go on the vessels. And a lot of this is going to be determined depending on the outcome today. There would be a group that would meet composed of industry, BIMS, BMRC, to determine these types of characteristics, where the areas would be. When should the season start? Do you really even want to start it as early as December 15th? Suppose it is a warm winter. So all these will be hashed out if we advertise. Here's a extensive list of what will be discussed in such a meeting. The season length and day length, individual quotas. So, for example, 1.5 million pounds was mentioned. This doesn't have to be a bushel limit. This could be an allocation to the dredgers that are there of 1,000 bushels. The study that Dr. Lipschitz reported on was 1,600 bushels, 1,600 bushels per participant. This would be 1,000 bushels per participant. The most it would be 1.5 million pounds if everyone did it, which is equal to the last dredge season amount, pretty much of 1.4 million pounds. The dredge areas, the sanctuary that was brought up earlier, that would have to be off limits. And that's not the first time that anyone's thought about that. But, I mean, I think Mr. Beck mentioned the idea of what are the crabs in the sanctuary? Well, they are the crabs you definitely want to protect. You can read along here, hail in, hail out. You're going out, you call the operation station. Coming back in, call the operation station. How much do you have? Let us know how much you have. Have tags that can be traced, just like the oyster fishery employed starting 2 years ago for the bags and everything. Observer monitoring, a license fee would have to be talked about. Identification. And no mercy, you lose your license. Violation is a loss of license. No license transfers, no agents. Bycatch allowances will have to be talked about. I mean, at least from the evidence from Dr. Lipschitz, the sand bottom is the horseshoe crab area, and there's a fishery that we already have enough difficulties with monitoring and everything else. We wouldn't want to compound that. So that'll have to be talked about. Here's the sanctuary, just to give you an idea. So what we're talking about in 1942 or 41, I've seen both referenced. This was established in code. And later in years, which is in the 22-point plan, this was expanded here in the bay so that the total is 865 square miles, including the sanctuary. And then in 2007, the commission had a trade-off situation where it was able to establish a coastal part of the sanctuary as well. So this has always been a critical area. This is just the limited winter dredge fishery season recommendation. To establish a limited crab dredge fishing season that begins no later than January 1, 2014, and ends no later than February 28, 2014, with a maximum tightly controlled quota of 1.5 million pounds that would be subject to conservation equivalency or compensation measures, maximum participation of 37 individuals who meet the qualifications established by limited entry criteria, crab dredging areas, season time limits, daily limits, license sales, and any additional provisions established in the evaluation and subject to the findings of the dredging work group would also be included. So we're going to come back to that. And Joe Grist is going to talk a lot about, but conservation equivalency.
Mr. Chairman?
Yep.
At the risk of being rude, how much longer is this meeting going to last? We've been sitting here for 5 hours.
Joe, how much longer do you have?
This should go 15 or less.
Right. 15 minutes for that, and then we have two other items on the agenda that will probably take 15 minutes.
Could we take a five-minute break?
Sure.
Do you have a stopwatch for Joe?
Yeah.
Okay. You want to take a break now?
All right, let's take a five-minute break. You want to do that?
Yeah.
All right, let's take a five-minute break, and then we'll come back and should finish up in a half hour or so.